going deep. I feel like Kalo on the Miami Heat. The words I speak off this sheet are like a three-peat. I don't just hop on a track, I bring running cleats. I'm a player for real, more than an athlete. Let my mama tell it, could have ran for the Senate. Instead I penned it for Donovan Bennett. I'm cemented, this a deep dive. In your headphones or a long drive. Up close and personal, just like you courtside. There ain't no out of bounds here, no offsides. We going live in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You are now tuned in to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
Better is right, it is the Going Deep podcast, and in this episode we're going to go deep on a sport that I love, but let's be honest, I've neglected for a little bit. We've had a lot of soccer and hockey of late. We talked about basketball coming to Canada in the form of the WNBA and the growth of the women's game thanks to Caitlin Clark, and the reduction of smart talk about women's basketball thanks to the Caitlin Clark effect. But we're talking all things football on this episode because football is relevant all of the time. Certainly it is here in Canada as the 2024 season is started and is underway. We saw Montreal go into Winnipeg and I want to say upset them. They were the betting underdog, but they are the defending champion. The last time they saw the two teams play was in the Grey Cup when Montreal beat Winnipeg, and Montreal has never lost to Winnipeg in a game one scenario, 7-0. And we also saw some odd things. Sean Lemon, who was suspended by the league indefinitely, not only played, was making plays because he is taking his case to arbitration. So we're in this weird purgatory, not knowing if this player is suspended forever or a real factor in 2024. So many interesting storylines as we go into this season, both positive and negative. That is sports. And I wanted to get the perspective from the man who has to rule on these cases, but also continue to grow the game at the same time. What excites him, what worries him, and what he's focused on, not just 2024 and beyond. He would be Randy Ambrosi, CFL commissioner. And as we get you set for all things CFL on this episode, let's go deep, listen to and learn from the commissioner of the CFL, Randy Ambrosi. So commissioner, we are on the eve of a new season. I wonder for you what the emotions are like, because I know it's just closing the chapter from the business season, if you will, to the playing season. Is this the feeling similar to birthing a new baby and having the world be able to tell you how cute it is?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure I would have used that specific reference, but I take the point. Yeah, you know what, Donovan? It's very exciting. It's been a busy business season, busy off season, as some call it. You know, we've made so much progress. I think the real excitement comes from how much progress we've made and how much momentum we have. And now we get to carry that through into a new season. Almost feels like a brand new thing because, you know, we're riding off of the dramatic growth in our TV ratings last year. You know, we had great performances in our major markets. We ended on such a positive note, such a great high with the Alouettes winning that dramatic Grey Cup. It just is exciting to start it all over again, but with a lot of momentum, a lot of wind in our sails.
You have so much that comes on your desk throughout the year, and you had to deal with less than ideal cases this offseason, both with Chad Kelly and Sean Lemon. For you, very different scenarios, obviously, but the challenge in adjudicating both of them fairly, but to have punishment that curbs behavior, for you was what?
Well, it's to treat each situation as its own, and it's to go through an education process. It's not to be quick to judge. It's to be to thoughtfully judge. It's to make sure that you've got all the facts. And, you know, Donovan, one of the challenges that comes with that is that oftentimes these things take longer than you want them to. And of course, you're feeling pressure to deal with them more urgently, but you have to have all In order to make the right decisions, you have to be in possession of all the facts. So that makes it somewhat difficult. And not everything's in our control, you know, and we have a relationship with the CFL Players Association that we have to respect. And so just because we want to do something doesn't necessarily mean we get to do it. And that's the nature of collective bargaining. So, you know, it's a complicated ecosystem. But in the end, we try to deal with each case on its own, and we try to do the right thing. And hopefully we get it right way more often than we get it wrong.
Getting it right is somewhat subjective, and your viewpoint often is based on how many of the facts you are able to ascertain. When people criticize, maybe not necessarily the league, but you personally, given how much you spend time thinking about these issues, trying to lead on them, that sits with you how?
Well, look, nobody likes to be criticized. I haven't met anybody, I suppose, that loves it. You accept it. You accept it as a part of the job. And you know, I try to be respectful of the different points of view that cross my desk. I'd like it when those points of view are expressed thoughtfully, and occasionally they are expressed emotionally, and sometimes with some hostility. But it's all part of what you have to do. It's all part of the job. And so, you know, in the end, I'm surrounded by really good people. I've got expert advisors that I listen to carefully, and I don't ever feel like I'm shouldering this burden alone. Sometimes maybe I'm the tip of the sword, but in the end, I don't feel like I'm shouldering it alone, because I've got colleagues that care a lot about this as well, and they all have the same motivation. They want us to get this right.
These are cases, especially with Kelly, where the punishment is adjudicated to individuals and not necessarily to teams. Are there other things that can be put in place, even though the gender-based violence policy is very clear, that allows for structure so that despite individual bad actors, you know, as a sport, we're not talking about these issues?
Well, there's always more to do, Donovan. I think that's key. In fact, I attended an ending violence meeting. It was the gender-based violence session yesterday afternoon here in Vancouver. And I was talking to the head of EVA, the Ending Violence Association. And we were talking about that very thing, that, you know, there's more to do. There's more education. There's some things, Donovan, cross my desk that are so clear and so black and white, they're not particularly difficult to adjudicate. Some things relating, so sexual violence is often very clear, and it is almost always comes with police involvement. So you're looking at police reports. There's a clear set of facts. In other, sexual harassment is less clear. It can be less clear, and doesn't often come with law enforcement involvement. And so you have to come at these things differently. And that's why we hire, you know, independent investigators, all of whom come from police backgrounds. So again, always things to learn. We've been talking about the policy. I met last week with a group of some of Canada's leading authorities in gender-based violence. And I asked them to critique our policy. And I got tremendous feedback that I was able to take away from that call. So again, their message was, Randy, you have to always be looking forward. You have to be thinking about, where do you go from here? You have to look for opportunities to improve your systems. And the one thing they remind me is, you need to focus on education, because education can be the silver bullet.
It's funny hearing you describe it that way, because that essentially is cut and paste your stance on player safety over the last couple of years. And this year we have the ability for players to wear guardian caps in game, something that we potentially could see in the National Football League as well. How did you get to that place not long after they were allowed to be worn and encouraged to be worn in practice, and the practicality of it. What will it look like? Will we see a Saskatchewan S on the side of a Guardian cap? Some teams have put numbers on their helmets in the past. What, if any, accommodations have to be made so that happens in a seamless manner?
Yeah, well, really, you have to shout out to Greg Dick and his crew in football operations, because they've been dealing with all of these things very thoughtfully. And when we started to get momentum on the idea of Guardian caps being made available into games as on a voluntary basis, then the question was, well, what are we going to do next? So Greg and his crew very quickly started working on a cap that fits over the Guardian cap that will have all the logos that are required. So, it's when you marshal resources and you've got people like Greg who can move very efficiently on issues, you find that you often come to solutions very quickly because you've got really good people. And that's what happened in this case.
You're not allowed to shout out Greg Dick without saying that he's proudly a Western Mustang. That is a prerequisite that
I never shout out for Greg Dick that he's a proud Western Mustang, because that's all Greg ever talks about.
That's right. Well, something that CFL fans and Canadians alike are talking about is the Jonas Brothers and them being the Twisted Tea halftime act. Everyone was wondering, with the BC Lions setting the bar so high to start the season with 50 Cent, how do you at all meet that level of entertainment? To me, it seemed like a clear sign that not only does the talent matter, but a global audience matters and the age of the audience matters. Am I overthinking this choice?
No. In fact, I think you got to go back to this, the group that worked on this, Amar Doman, Dwayne Veneau, Greg and I, and really, first of all, Amar's got a better playlist than I do. I'll start there. But what I found in Amar is he's very intuitive about what works, and he is passionate about creating an opportunity for the next generation of fans to become lifetime CFL fans. So his real emphasis was on getting an act that would really appeal to multiple generations, but really resonate with younger Canadians and younger football fans. And that's the conversation that was started. The other is we agreed we needed to try to get this done quickly, much earlier, so that we could share this news early in the process rather than later in the process. And the music industry has changed so dramatically in the past several years, but really, it was Amar's playlist and his sense of, he has a vision. It's a very clear vision to reach into the community, to make the Lions, the BC Lions, the all BC Lions. They've got a 50 community tour going on right now. There will be in Victoria for Touchdown Pacific. And then for him, it's about welcoming this group of younger Canadians into the CFL family. And it all came together so beautifully. And I knew it worked because my three daughters all wrote within about 8 minutes of the announcement, just so excited that the Jonas Brothers were playing halftime.
So excited, and I'm sure asking for multiple tickets at the same time. You mentioned you as a parent, and my wife always lectures me that I can't communicate that I have a favorite child, but I do. I'll tell you offline which one it is. Okay. But when I look at Amar as a member of the league, as an asset, as someone who's pushing thought, I wonder his inclusion to the Board of Governors, in what ways have you, not said he's your favorite child, but been able to tap into his ability to be a rising tide that can lift all boats?
Yeah, well, I think first of all, he is incredibly well respected on the Board of Governors, and you can see when he speaks, you can see that the points he makes are very well listened to. But Donovan, maybe as important as that, I think what's been happening within the league is this growing momentum around collaboration, and I think what we're seeing now. And not surprisingly, what we're seeing now is teams are feeding off of each other's successes. So last year, it wasn't just that we had a significant improvement in attendance in Vancouver for the Lions, but we had significant improvement in attendance in Toronto, and we had an improvement in attendance in Montreal. It wasn't that long ago. You and I might have been talking about the major markets being a source of concern, and last year there was a source of great pride that those markets were performing. I think it's what happens when good things start to happen. And of course, it's easier for Toronto and Montreal to relate to Vancouver as a market than it is for Toronto and Montreal to relate to Winnipeg. And that's one thing that the presidents are quick to point out is the markets are all so different, but some markets are more alike than they are different. So that's been true. The other is you can't dismiss the power of management council, which is the team presidents and myself and my executive team, which even at this past Board of Governors meeting, there was a shout out for how much more collaborative that group is now, maybe more collaborative than ever in our history. And there's a lot of idea sharing amongst that group. So I think what's happened is the flywheel has started to turn, the momentum is building, and the teams are feeding off of each other's successes. And again, no doubt that Amar has brought a level of energy and commitment that is unmistakable.
Well, what those organizations have in common is added competition, specifically in the market. When I look at the value add for the CFL, distinctly Canadian, cost affordable, and family friendly. Well, now, just after a couple of years, you have the CEBL, you have the PWHL, you will, in successive summers, have the NSL and a WNBA Toronto team. For you in your league, looking at continuing to hold and grow market share in what's going to be a busy sports calendar, what are the objectives and are there potential learnings from some of the upstart leagues that we've seen in Canada?
Well, we don't, we're not overly preoccupied with everyone else because we spend most of our time thinking about how do we grow from here. But you do watch, and the teams all watch to see what others are doing. Look, I think one of the things that I believe has really been transformational for the CFL is this growing confidence in our own value proposition. So as you know, Donovan, we've talked before. We launched a significant market research study back in 2019. It was designed to really help us understand our own brand and how we were perceived in the marketplace. And it identified two key areas for us to focus on. This one being kind of this notion of competition, and the other of community. And in the competition, it was distilled down to our value proposition has three elements: fun, fast, and entertaining. And that's creates for us an understanding that you don't have to be biggest to be best. You don't have to be biggest to be fun, fast, and entertaining. You just have to be fun, fast, and entertaining. And that all on its own is attractive. But on the other side, this is something that I think we do, I believe, not disrespecting anyone else, I think we do community as well, if not better, than any other league in the world. And our athletes are the ones you give the shout out to. Our athletes show up in our communities in very unique ways, but they do it 24/7. So it's the strength of understanding ourselves that's really, really helped us. So yes, there's a lot going on around us, but when you believe in yourself, when you believe in the power of your own product, when you actually have a little bit, maybe not arrogance, but you have a little swagger that what we've got is pretty special and it's got a special history and it's got a really good future, then all of a sudden some of that noise is a little less profound and a little less distracting.
Well, from the former offensive lineman, I didn't have fun, fast, entertaining, and swagger as the adjectives on the bingo card I was expecting you to pull out. But it just shows as the league progresses, as the sports market progresses, as do you. Thank you so much. Enjoy the fun, fast, and entertaining action this weekend and throughout the year. And yeah, we'll see some of that swagger both on the field and on stage. So I'm looking forward to it.
Great, Donovan. It's great to see you again. Best of wishes. Best of luck to you and your family. And I will see you very soon.
Yeah, best of luck to you divvying up those tickets to your family.
Yeah, thank you. Take care, Donovan.
Thank you so much to Randy Ambrosi. You can hear why he's bullish about the continual growth of the league. It's a league that we've had longer than any other in this country yet. I think it's still ascending. The arrow is still pointing up. That certainly is the case for the National Football League. And after the break, we're going to talk about their broadcast plan. Recently, it was announced that, if we're talking about the CFL, they are going to have even wider reach when it comes to broadcast because 7 regular season games are going to be on CTV. You're going to see some division finals on CTV and obviously the Grey Cup on CTV. Well, the broadcast planning in the NFL is essentially done by people who are Mensa level smart because there are so many factors you have to weigh and consider. Well, we're going to be joined by their VP of broadcast planning, Mike North, after the break to talk about the new frontier for the NFL, streamers and international games and games on Christmas Day. All that next.
My name is Lucille Bryan.
I'm Clifton Bryan.
My grandson has a show.
And I'm so happy that you are listening to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
I'm so glad that he had a show. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Grandma and Granddad. And I remember as a kid going to their house for holidays, albeit Thanksgiving or Christmas, and always thinking about what sports are going to be on, how are you going to manage the two TVs, one in the living room and one in the basement, and what to watch. Because as a Canadian, if we're talking about the NFL now, you only had so many options. Here in Southern Ontario, you were going to get the Bills game. You were probably going to get the Lions game, depending on, you know, who had the NFC or who had the AFC at the time from a broadcast perspective. There was a time when it was strictly NFC, Fox, AFC, CBS. Now, those lines are very much blurred. You'll hear why in a second. But now, we don't have those issues. You can watch all the games on your phone, on a tablet, on an app. Just on normal cable, you get 6, 7, 8 games in a week, depending on how many buys are that week. We are spoilt when it comes to our options in watching the NFL, but sometimes too much of something actually isn't good. It can become bad. And as we continue to see games go to more broadcast partners and be played on more days and in more countries, it's a slippery slope where that actually might take away from the experience. I wanted to learn how the league is balancing all of that, where you want to make more money and you want to reach more customers, but at the same time, you want those games to mean something and be special. Mike North is the person charged with getting up every day and thinking about that. The schedule for this upcoming season has recently been announced, and of course, all of the partners, including a new one in Netflix, super thrilled. Netflix will have two Christmas Day games. I wanted to figure out how this puzzle is put together and what this puzzle might look like in the future, because it looks much different now than it did even 5 years ago. So let's go deep and listen to and learn from Mike North on all things NFL broadcast and scheduling. So Mike, I want to give you congrats and a virtual hug, as I imagine the process of going through all the permutations and possibilities and scheduling realities and partners must be akin to running a marathon for you and your group. When the schedule's out, what does that feel like?
I appreciate the virtual hug. Thank you. That's exactly what it feels like. It's a marathon, not a sprint. It's a 14-week grind through thousands and thousands of possible NFL schedules, all of which would probably be fine, but, you know, we're looking for the one that best possible television, best possible fan experience, least amount of competitive inequities, manage your way around your travel considerations for teams traveling three time zones for regular season games or international travel, ticket sales, weather, literally everything you could think of all goes into one big stew, and we just keep it on simmer and just keep tasting it and adding a little of this and taking away a little of that. And hopefully when we finish, everybody's well fed.
I'm in the content business, and after my meal is done, it's out there for the world to devour, I suppose. But I'm always like, should I have added a little bit more salt? Should I let it cook a little bit longer? Like, I'm never actually happy with it. Are you? Can you look back and
no,
say?
Exactly the same thing. Exactly the same thing. Constantly, you know, not just in the last couple of weeks since the schedule's come out, kind of kicking ourselves for, should we have done this, or what would have happened if we'd have done that instead. But also, you know, season doesn't even start for 4 months. And so by the time the season kicks off and you get a couple of weeks in and you start realizing, like we did last year, we might have missed seeing the Houston Texans coming, or we might have, you know, over-relied on somebody or some team. And it's a constant battle, you know, internally, externally. The result is out there, but we do have some levers to pull. We do have, you know, flexible scheduling and opportunities to tinker a little bit and some TBDs and stuff like that. So, you know, it's not like a podcast where you put it out there and it's out there forever and you're stuck with it. We do get, you know, I don't want to call it a mulligan, but we do get a chance to, you know, fix some ills if we were really wrong and have an opportunity to address some of that.
We're at the point where a computer could just literally make the schedule. You could say, AI, give me the best NFL schedule, and it would spit something out, and you could just say, here it is, take it or leave it. Talk to me about the actual human component and why that maybe isn't necessarily fair to all parties.
Yeah, look, we are nothing if not open-minded about, you know, AI and ML and quantum and all those fancy buzzwords. I mean, we're trying to solve an impossibly difficult mathematical equation. We'll take all the help we can get. Not sure I ever see us completely turning it over to the tech. There's got to be some room in here for the humans. There's got to be some room for gut and feel and instinct. We've got people on this team who are incredibly dedicated, incredibly smart, incredibly experienced. You know, a guy like Howard Katz ran ABC Sports and ESPN for a while, ran NFL Films for a while, ran the NFL scheduling process for 15 years. And I'm not sure we just want to say, hey, we don't need you anymore. We've got a piece of tech that can do this for us now. There's always got to be some room for, you know, nuance and common sense, hopefully. You know, all of us have our lives controlled by the data and the tech and the AI in some sense, but never want to lose that personal touch, never want to lose that human touch. You know, the computers are brilliant, but they're also kind of stupid, right? They'll only do what you tell them to do. And so you got to make sure you tell it everything that you want it to think of. And I'm not sure we've gotten to that point yet. So sometimes, you know, like any artist, you know, Howard Katz will look at a schedule and he'll say, it just doesn't quite feel right. Well, I'm not sure how to write a mathematical equation for that. Or, you know, sounds like a football game. Like, I don't know what the X and Y variables are that, you know, make something sound like a football game to Howard Katz. But I still trust his gut and instinct and feel for at least a few more years until the tech, you know, truly catches up to everything we're trying to do here.
What I love about this process is the schedule comes out, and then your colleague, Rich Eisen, interviews all of the lead play-by-play guys, and one after one they come on, and Al Michaels says, you know what, I love the schedule that we've got this year on Amazon, and then Jim Nantz says, you know what, we got so many Chiefs games on CBS, I love the schedule. I don't know if it's possible for everyone to think that their personal baby is cute. How much input do the different broadcasters have in what their schedule is? Is there any preference? Do you give them chance to give them, you know, their best and final in terms of a game or a lead game that they really, really want?
There's not a lot of back and forth. Everybody gets a shot kind of early in the process, teams and media partners. Here's a couple things that we're thinking about. Here's some stuff that, you know, we'd like for you to consider this year while you're putting this puzzle together. Oh, by the way, it's been five straight years that you've done us wrong in this way or that way. You know, everybody's got a long memory. Everybody's got strong opinions. So everybody gets a shot at the scheduling team. Everybody gets to submit their request forms. But then once those forms come in, maybe kind of revisit them again after free agency, but kind of close and lock the door at some point. Can't keep iterating, can't keep going back and forth with everybody because nobody's ever satisfied. So when you hear, you know, the Jim Nantz, the Al Michaels, the, you know, everybody, Joe Buck talking about, hey, we love our schedule, I hope it's true. I mean, I hope everybody feels like they got something. Nobody gets everything. But hopefully everybody gets a little something, and that's sort of the dance here. You want everybody walking away feeling like they got a little something. It is, after all, a zero-sum game, right? Anything that's good for NBC is bad for CBS. Anything that's good for the Detroit Lions is bad for the Green Bay Packers. So you know it's going to be hard to please everybody. So everybody's going to be disappointed, hopefully just a little and hopefully pretty evenly.
And now some of the big partners have a little bit of less of something. You have Netflix as a partner, so that takes away two primetime games. You've got some Monday night doubleheaders. Obviously, Thursday night football is more of a thing. How cognizant, if at all, are you about protecting what those 4 o'clock windows look like, especially late in the year when you have buys, making sure that people are happy with the package that they paid a lot of money for?
Yeah, that's probably maybe the biggest challenge we have right now is as we slice this pie thinner and thinner and the inventory keeps wandering away from Sunday afternoons to 9:30 a.m. Eastern time kicks in Europe or, like you mentioned, the Monday side-by-sides, additional Thursdays, now Christmas Wednesdays. Like, that inventory is coming from somewhere. And again, zero-sum game, there's a finite number. There's 272 games. Every one you take away from Sunday afternoon just kind of thins out that pie, makes that map for CBS and Fox just a little bit more challenging. So constant debate, discussion, iteration, really trying to figure out, you know, the value of each of these 272 assets, you know, not, you know, business assets to the NFL. It's not like they're all worth a different amount of money. It's their assets that belong to the fans. And we want to make sure that the fans are getting access to the assets that are most important to them. So we're not doing our jobs if we take all the best inventory away from Sunday night and put it all in primetime and leave Sunday afternoons, you know, a little too thin. That's really the bread and butter for the NFL. It's what we all grew up, you know, watching on Sunday afternoons with our family, with our parents, you know, the home team at 1 o'clock and then the big doubleheader game at 4 o'clock. And it wasn't that long ago. That was it, right? And then became Sunday night football, Monday night football, and everything else we've got now. So, you know, can't take all the best stuff away for primetime, but also can't leave all the best stuff on Sunday afternoon because depending on how many games there are and what other games are in the window, you know, a 1 o'clock Sunday game might only be available in 15, 18, 20% of the country. Not sure that's the best use of each of these assets too. So every schedule gets evaluated top to bottom, soup to nuts, right to left. And part of the analysis of every finished schedule isn't just the prime times and the national windows. It's also the Sunday afternoons. And yeah, they're getting more and more challenging. And like you said, sometimes you find a week with teams, four teams on bye, maybe six teams on bye. I'm kind of dreading the conversation that's going on right now where they talk about, you know, if we go to 18 games over 19 weeks or 18 games over 20 weeks and every team has a second bye. And think about some of these thin Sunday afternoons when you get in October and November now, and that's only with 32 byes. If we've got to cram 64 byes into this puzzle somewhere, I'm – definitely wary of some of these Sunday afternoons getting just a little bit too thin. I'm curious to see where that conversation goes.
Well, that's where my mind went when you said there's a finite number of games of, you know, 272, because there are some interested parties and stakeholders who feel like, well, that number doesn't have to be finite. I mean, we could take away from the preseason, we could lengthen the season and maybe push the Super Bowl back so that the next day ends up being a United States holiday. If you were given a chance to speak to the Board of Governors of the PA and make a case as to why maybe not everything that glitters is gold, what would you say about the benefits of keeping the number where it is now?
It's a good question. Look, I think any fan would gladly trade a preseason game for a regular season game. So, you know, 18 games over 19 weeks. I guess what I would say when they say, well, what are we going to do about two byes? I think what I would say is, you know, if we use the Thursday games strategically and you get, you know, call it a mini bye, that 10-day break after your Thursday game, you know, almost every team in the league plays a Thursday. Some teams are playing two. If we can spread out your Thursday and your bye, or your two Thursdays and your bye, you know, maybe we can find a way to do this in a, you know, player-friendly way that doesn't require that second bye week. Because if you do get that second bye week, like we said, I'm not sure anybody's taking the bye weeks 1, 2, 3. I don't think we want byes weeks, you know, 16, 17, 18, or 17, 18, 19. So that's, what, 15 weeks where we've got to cram in 64 byes? That's an awful lot of teams not playing, taking a really tough puzzle and making it even tougher. I'm sure we'd find a way. We'll do what's best for the league, of course, but I'd love to see if there wasn't some conversation we could have where that second bye wasn't necessarily tied to the, you know, the expansion of the regular season. I think everybody would trade the one preseason for the extra regular season, and you do get that bye between the end of the preseason and the regular season, so everybody starts pretty fresh. And again, maybe there's a rule or a series of rules we can write where you can't go too many weeks without at least one rest period, but you don't necessarily need that second one.
Well, what complicates that and that rest period is, for you over the years, the international games, the increasing number of them, and now the varied places with which they take place, given that player health and safety is still a priority. What impact does those international games have on you when you're trying to map out the schedule?
They're kind of a starting point. You know, can't really build a schedule without it. We've announced that we're playing these games in Europe. We've drafted volunteers. We've got ourselves a handful of willing participants. So we definitely are going to find a way to fit those games in. The real challenge for us is trying to figure out what's the real impact of traveling to one of these international games. When a East Coast team, when an Eastern time zone team in the United States travels over to London, plays a game in the afternoon in the UK, morning time here in the States, they're often back in their airport, back in their facility, you know, not that long after midnight. And that same team playing a road game at Seattle or San Francisco may not get back till 3 or 4 in the morning. So I'm not sure a game in the UK in the afternoon over there, morning over here, is that disruptive. I'd love to get a better sense of how routine that is. And I think you're seeing it when the teams are opting, you know, not to go over, spend the whole week in the UK. They're just going over Friday, Saturday, treating it like a normal game week, and then opting not to take their bye the week immediately following the Europe trip. They'll just take a home game and push that bye later. Like we said, it's a long season. You want to use that rest period, you know, strategically if you can. So I think the Europe games are becoming, routine might not be the right word, but closer to routine. But some of the other stuff we're talking about, some of the other stuff you see in the press, whether it's Brazil this year or maybe Australia next year, those don't sound very routine. So we're definitely going to have to make some considerations and accommodations and find a couple of willing clubs and figure out the right way to do it. If it's a Eastern team, are they going west and playing in Los Angeles and then going over to Australia from there? If it's a Western team, can they go on a Friday? Can we play on a Friday night, get back and, you know, off the opening Sunday, but then pick up week 2 9 days later, like we're doing with Brazil this year? Lots of discussion, lots of options. Again, I think everybody recognizes the challenge, but I think everybody recognizes the benefit. It is truly a spectacle when we play these international games. The demand is there, the fanhood is there, and it's probably only going to grow as you start to see things like, you know, flag football in the Olympics. I think we really are becoming a global game, and that requires us to, you know, bring our product to different portions of the globe. And yeah, challenge for the scheduling team, but we'll figure it out.
As you mentioned, those European games becoming a little bit more commonplace and manageable, not routine, but manageable, could you see it being viable, something that has been speculated before in the past, of having a team and or a division in Europe?
Yeah, I could see a division, right? That kind of makes sense. Could we ever have it, you know, a couple in London, one in Spain, one in Germany, and those four kind of, you know, whatever you'd call it, the European division, and they'd all play each other. And, you know, the real challenge would be, you know, for those four or even for just the one, you know, the travel. Are we going to ping pong back and forth? Like we said, maybe it's not routine, but it's manageable, but still back and forth across the ocean sounds like a lot, 8 or 10 times a year. So you'd probably have to come to the States, stay here for a couple of weeks, play like a 3-game road trip and play, you know, 3 teams in the States and then go back and then, you know, host 3 games in a row. So you're really not ping ponging back and forth. That requires a U.S. base of operations. And there's obviously going to be some costs involved with that. Probably training camp here in the States, just because players are getting waived and cut and picked up all the time. I think you got to be able to get those guys in and out of your building, in and out of your facility, on and off your roster. So there's a lot of logistical challenges. You never say never. I mean, we're doing things right now that I wasn't sure we'd ever be doing in the 30 years I've been with the company. So never say never, but I think it's going to be a ways away, but definitely something we're going to keep talking about. And look, if the demand is there operationally, I'm sure we'll figure it out.
And lastly, you talked about the 30 years for the company. It seems on the outside looking in, whether it's the broadcast deals with streamers or the international games, that for the league, the thought first and foremost is international and global and not necessarily just being the event in the United States, but being the event worldwide. Is that fair to say that that is the current, you know, mantra of where the organization's going?
You know, it's probably a lot like the conversation we were just having. Like, you're pulling games out of Sunday afternoon to create these new additional windows, but you're obviously not going to forget about your Sunday afternoons. That's your bread and butter. I got to figure it's the same way for us now, right? We're definitely taking inventory out of this country and finding ways to deploy it internationally. But what, it's 6 out of 272 games? Like, you know, the overwhelming majority of our games are still going to be played in the States. The media interest is still here in the States. I'm sure we're trying to build, you know, an international audience, a global audience. Some of that comes with, you know, our streaming partners. When you talk about a Netflix being able to, you know, literally do the first truly global sports rights deal, one partner, one sports league, one day, truly global broadcast. Like, yeah, that's something that's exciting and new and innovative, and I'm sure we're going to keep looking for ways to do that and find our fans wherever they are, whether it's, you know, international or on their devices, you know, in their pockets or wherever we're going to be in 5 or 10 years. We're already doing things none of us could have imagined 5 years ago. Who knows how we're going to be getting our content 5 years from now, but I'm sure we're going to keep fishing where the fish are. And look, the fans will tell us, right? They will tell us what's important to them. They will tell us how to reach them. Every time a fan interacts with us, whether they're attending a game, you know, downloading an app or watching a video online or buying a hat or a t-shirt or a ticket or following somebody on Instagram or placing a legal sports bet. I mean, every time they interact with us, they're telling us what's important to them. And I do think one thing the NFL does really well is we listen to the fans. And when they tell us that, hey, you know what, if you put a playoff game on Peacock, we'll find it, you know, they did. You know, you want to play a game on Black Friday and, you know, 10 million people found it last year. Hopefully 15 million people find it this year. Amazon's going to pick up a playoff game. Peacock's going to be broadcasting the Brazil game and obviously Netflix on Christmas now. Like, trying new things, but not necessarily forgetting how we got here you know, never going to be at the expense, I don't think, of the domestic fan. This is still an American sport, but certainly with an eye towards some global expansion. And again, I think flag football in the Olympics is going to be a real game changer for us all. It'll be fascinating to see what happens over these next 8 or 10 years as flag continues to grow. And, you know, we create not only football fans, but football players all across the planet.
It will be certainly fascinating. Our Canadian audience will be watching and giving you more data points. But certainly, as I watch to see where it goes, I'm real curious if future conversation we're talking about a Super Bowl on a streamer, the Netflix The Dumb before the Super Bowl starts, or a Super Bowl internationally, or technology that we don't know of yet being big in these games. It will probably give you more work to do and more things to contemplate.
Great. Can't wait.
Yeah, exactly. It is a thankless job, but thank you for not only doing it for us so that we can enjoy this season, but giving us some context around it as well.
Absolute pleasure, Donovan. Always good to talk to you.
Thanks so much to Mike. And even though we are in the dog days of summer, if you will, we're still compelled with all things NFL. Riveting conversation with Mike. Can't wait to catch up with him to see what the next big thing the NFL does. And one last thing. Before you go, here's the latest Canada's Ultimate Challenge episode recap with me and our good friend, Cabrel Richards. Once again on the Going Deep podcast, we go deep on Canada's Ultimate Challenge. On this episode, episode 6, we go west to Revelstone, BC. And this is all about the reveal of the ultimate wild card. Brandon loves dropping the twist on him.
But how we got there, the gondola to gondola challenge.
Yes.
Gondolas are quiet, they're peaceful, they're relaxing. It's easy like a Sunday morning. But the energy in this challenge was like, imagine being at a concert, front row, you're up against like the guardrail, and then the crowd behind you is like moving towards the stage and like crushing you up against the guardrail. It's fight or flight, and you're trying to like push them back. Like your heart rate's at 180 BPM. Okay, there are two gondolas. Two members of the team, because there's only three players on a team now, have to climb up the gondola, walk across a cable to another gondola, then pull up a support beam. Someone has to walk across that beam, and then they have to like reverse rappel to like another gondola. So it's all upper body strength. You're totally burned out. Then they have to pull a teammate up who's just suspended in midair, not sure how far down. But at that point, they're just totally gassed. And Team Orange, great strategy by having Jack as the team member who's suspended in midair, because Jack, as we said in a previous episode, is like 95 pounds, 4'11", height doesn't measure heart. And Team Red, similar strategy with Lekka and Sandrick pulling up Courtney. Courtney's also, I don't know, 5'1", 98 pounds. Team Blue, big mistake. Adam was like, you know what? I don't want to gas out early. My upper body strength, I'm not sure, which I can appreciate, but that dude's like 210, 220. So Harvin and Angel pulling that guy up was just a total disaster and just ate up so much of the clock.
Lift Adam, you have to wonder, was this the right strategy to put the heaviest guy there at the bottom?
Adam clearly didn't understand the assignment because he didn't help himself by trying to pull himself on the cable that was available to him until, what, two-thirds through the competition?
Yeah, we saw Jack do that first, and she realized, like, oh, I can just pull and alleviate some pressure, pull on this, and so, which helped her move up onto that platform quicker. And Adam, yeah, it was too late by the time he figured it out. He's like, I could have been doing this from the beginning. Like, yeah, homie, you could have been, but you didn't.
The black rope that's behind Adam is what Jack grabbed onto to start pulling herself up, and then it would help them do this.
Hey, is this pull? If I pull on this, will this pull me up?
Yeah.
Why didn't I think of that?
And Team Blue had to finish first or second to avoid the elimination challenge. And Team Blue didn't finish first or second.
Team Red wins, so they win double points, win the region. Blue, after finishing second forever, got hot last episode, won themselves a couple competitions, and now they're back basically fighting for their future. But we also get now the wild card.
Yeah.
Team White.
Hey, guys.
Hello.
Hey.
Oh, hello. What are you doing here?
We have some business to take care of.
Okay.
The bad news? That player cut was real. The good news? You're not leaving this competition just yet. All three of you...
Get out.
...are forming...
No.
...our new ultimate wildcard team. Grab these shirts. Grab these shirts.
Yeah.
Can I say, the white outfits were fire.
Yeah, they did. They were really clean. Like, Brandon, Whitney, Chastity came in with the new kit and new energy. They've been, you know, they had a nice sleep. They're just, now they're like, they have a second chance at this competition, the possibility of winning it and going to Paris and watching the summer game. So they have, there's a new battery in their back. Before we get to the wild card team entering the elimination challenge, we see the teams having to plead their case again. And then there's Adam just activating his Adam Driver. And he's like, he has a little one-on-one with Courtney. And she's like kind of interested in what he's trying to say. And like, maybe he's just, again, going for the heartstrings. And he's like, do you want to face off against the best of the competition? Or you want to be logical about how this is going to play out? Like, I'm the one that set up the alliance with Team Red and Team Orange when I was a member of Team Red. Hey, you have this opportunity now to get rid of, like, your best competition, Team Orange, or not get rid of them, but put them in this elimination challenge. Like, what are you going to do?
Every episode, we hear from Orange, we have this alliance with Team Red. We have this alliance with Team Red. How has this alliance benefited Team Red?
I think it's been both ways.
I could be mistaken. I feel like it hasn't been both ways.
I love the moment where Adam steps off of the podium as though he's Tom Cruise in A Few Good Men. He's like, "Honor, Your Honor, may I approach the bench?" And then he makes a plea directly. Again, look at him, just straight eye contact, looking at the members of Team Red. Great gamesmanship by Adam, and I'm surprised it worked.
Evidently, Team Red chooses to throw in Team Orange, which was
what a twist, man. Because earlier in the episode, Jenny was like, "I will feel so betrayed if Team Red puts us in the elimination challenge as she represents Team Orange."
"This feels like trash. I can't even look at Team Red right now. It actually feels horrible that Sandrick is on the team that threw us into the elimination. We built a bond with Team Red, and in putting us in the showdown today, they crushed that bond."
I love Jenny, one of my favorite players on the entire show. But she's talking about, we have this bond. We have this bond. You know what bond I'm thinking about? I'm thinking about the bonbons in Paris that they have.
But listen, they form bonds over in competition, going through the shared experience of these grueling challenges across the country.
When can I take this bond and take it to the bank and cash it in? Like, no. Unfortunately,
it's not a federal bond, unfortunately. But yeah, Jenny was devastated. Like, and there was just like, okay, you guys are dead to me.
And we have to compete against each other for the finale. Like, what's the big loss for me? Like, you're not going to like me when I beat you later? Like, okay.
So they get to prove which team is the worst. Correct. In this head-to-head canoe tug of war. So Team Orange is in a canoe, Team White, or the wildcard team, is in a canoe, and they are nose to nose, like tip to tip, and they have to push the other team into the boundary. So picture like a boxing ring, like a giant boxing ring. They're in this lake, and just using sheer brute force, whichever team can push the other into one of the sides wins the round. It's a best of three. And right away, Team Orange comes out the gate. It's like, all right, here's our first, bam, left, right, boom, body shot, uppercut, boom. It was a quick round.
I thought it was going to be a quick competition because they won so convincingly. I was like, oh, it's a wrap.
So then in round two, the wildcard team is like, all right, let's just power up these backpacks that we have here. Great resolve by Shazali, Brandon, and Whitney to win round two.
It's almost like, you know, do the producers have this in a wave pool where they're just controlling which way the waves are going? Because it set up a perfect tiebreaker. But the fact that both teams won so convincingly, I found.
Hey, listen, it's not the size of the dog in the fight. It's the size of the fight in the dog.
I suppose.
And we go to round three. I just can't imagine how tired these people were. Arms burning, throats burning, lungs burning, just trying to, looking the other team in the eye, just trying to impose your will against them. And the wildcard team's fighting back and pushing back. And they were like 10 meters away from the edge. And now it's 15. and now it's 20, and now it's 30, and now they're pushing Orange towards a corner, and there's a moment where Jenny just breaks. And miraculously, the wild card team wins the canoe tug of war challenge. And this was just a magical moment for Canada's ultimate challenge.
I love it. I giving my MVP to Adam, because not only did he politic, but he also came through in the challenges. And it's huge because not only did they not get eliminated, but they stayed fresh.
My episode 6 MVP was Lekka. She does not break a sweat. She is the ultimate competitor. Again, I think she is powered by the sun because she does not tire out.
In the finale, which we will have an entire episode just dedicated to the finale, in episode 7, Vancouver Island, 9 players. Do you have a prediction?
My episode 1 prediction was Team Orange to win the whole thing.
Correct.
That is now out the window. So my prediction is Team Red wins Canada's ultimate challenge.
My heart says Team Red. My head says Team Blue. But the producer in me says Team White. It's basically, Nani, you don't get mad at me, because I kind of threw a little bit of something at all of you. Either way, I will be watching. The same CBC Gem, the finale, episode 7. Can't wait.
Don't miss new episodes of Canada's Ultimate Challenge every Sunday at 8. Watch free on CBC Gem.